Let's have a brief word of prayer as we get started. Our Father, we thank you for the time you give us, and we thank you tonight for this time. And I pray that this time will be used by your Spirit to continue the process of bringing us each closer to your word. And I pray that you would give me the right words to say to carry across the ideas that you would like to have people hear. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen. Now, I'd like this time specifically for you to get your notes out. Everybody's got a set of notes, right? We do have a couple in the closet for people who might be late coming. Okay, what I would like for you to do is I would like you to look in your notes and you will find two lesson fives. There's a lesson 5A and there's a lesson 5B. I'd like for you to look at the first page of Lesson 5A. Have you found that? The first sentence in bold: between the end of the Old Testament record and the beginning of the New Testament is a period of almost 400 years, and what happens across that 400 years changes the landscape so that it's almost unrecognizable. The world into which Jesus was born is very different from the world at the end of the New Testament. There have been several major world-conquering powers come and go in that time period. The Romans are in charge of the world, and the Romans hardly were on the map at the end of the Old Testament. The Greeks have come under Alexander the Great and have faded, but boy, their influence remains. Now, I'll leave the details for you to read, but here's what I want you to understand. There's an Old Testament section. It says something like this: in the fullness of time, the Messiah came. And if you start looking at what the world was like when Jesus was born, what you find is certain features did not exist for 1,000 years before and did not exist for 1,000 years after. There was a very small window in time in which these things existed. One was a near universal language. The educated populace of a whole part of the European, Middle Eastern, and Near Asian world spoke Greek. Whatever other languages you might speak, you probably also speak Greek if you had any education at all. And if you needed to deal with educated classes, you probably learned that. What's the parallel in our day? English. You go to Africa. And whatever other languages people may speak, one of the first things they do in schooling their children is get them to begin to learn English. It's the first time in almost 2,000 years that that's been true, that there's been a language that's been universal. The second thing was transportation. You could go pretty much as far as you wanted to go in the world of that time. That leaves out China and that leaves out the Western Hemisphere because they didn't know that existed. But pretty much as far as you wanted to go, you could go, because there were not boundaries of political or economic nature that would stop you from traveling. And the roads were good. The Roman system had great roads, and the Roman process brought in provinces all over the world, and one of the things they did was put up transportation systems. Jim Pardue stood in our pulpit and talked about a time, this is one of our former pastors, for those of you who don't know him, stood in our pulpit and talked about living in Germany for 3 years and serving as pastor of a church over there and being in a city called Aachen, I think it was, in Germany, which at the time of Jesus was the end of the civilized world. It was barbarian country beyond there. And within 50 years of Jesus' crucifixion, there was a Christian church in Aachen. There was a building that was built for the purpose of the worship of our Lord. The whole of the Roman Empire was saturated with Christian witness because the language system allowed it and the roads allowed it. Move forward 100 years and that starts to fade. The battles and the breakup of the Roman Empire was even beginning then. Travel wasn't quite as easy. Go 400 years and certainly that was true. And go 50 to 100 to 70 to 150 years before Jesus and it wouldn't have been true. In the fullness of time, Messiah came. Now,
that's about all I want to talk about as far as the context. But I will tell you that there's some interesting things in here for you to read in the list that I have in each one of these sections, and I do encourage you to do that. Look at the bottom of page 2, the second half of page 2. A couple of things I want to make sure you see. The Old Testament is properly called the Jewish Bible. The Christian Bible would have the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, plus a section that talks about Jesus, which we call the New Testament. For Christians, the Old Testament is extremely helpful. The New Testament is essential. I hope I've convinced you the Old Testament has a lot to say. Look at number 3, the comparison. Old Testament has how many books? 39. New Testament? 27. But the books are a whole lot smaller on average in the New Testament. So the New Testament's about a third the size of the Old Testament. It's not equal, and it's not even half in terms of just the number of words. Time frame for the Old Testament, close to 3,000 years, if you don't count the unknown time periods for the creation and all that. If you start with Abraham and go to the end of the Old Testament records, about 3,000 years, 2,500 to 3,000 years. The New Testament, the record is close to 85 years, less than 100 years certainly. The focus for the Old Testament is on the nation of Israel. The focus of the New Testament is on the person of Jesus. And as far as the people group for the Old Testament, the focus was on the Jews as a people group. In the New Testament, the focus is on every people group. You can really see this in the book of Acts if you sort of walk along and watch that. The geography is Israel in the Old Testament, plus Assyria, Babylon, Egypt primarily. In the New Testament, it's Israel plus Greece, Rome, and the entire Roman Empire. In the New Testament, there are 27 books. 4 of them are books that we call the Gospels. Gospel is a Greek word, I think, Greek word whose literal meaning is good news. Gospel equals good news. And that's the story of Jesus' life. There's one book of history, that's the book of Acts. There's 21 letters, most of them by Paul, or Paul and a group of people with him. And there's one book of apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature means end of the world kind of stuff. Daniel and Ezekiel have some elements of that in the Old Testament. Revelation in the New Testament does. Our approach is going to be that tonight we're going to talk about the Gospels. The next time we meet, we're going to talk about Paul's letters. The next time we meet, we're going to talk about all the other letters. And the last time we meet, we're going to talk about the book of Revelation. That means we're leaving out the book of Acts, and that's awful. That's terrible. We shouldn't do that. But I'd have to have a ninth week to really do that right. So I'm going to try to sneak in some things from Acts as we're doing the letters and some other things. And you'll see that we'll work on that a little bit. So far, okay? All right. Now, if you'll turn to the next page, which I hope is page 5B, the first page of 5B. Now, I'm not going to do what I do some years. There's an introduction there you can look at. I'll just say this much. If you go into Ezekiel, you go into Revelation, you go into a couple of the other apocalyptic books, there's a very strange creature that is mentioned as having been seen in the visions people have of God and the presence of God. And that strange being has 4 faces. One is the face of a man, one is the face of a lion, one is the face of an ox, one is the face of an eagle. And there are people who equate those 4 faces with the 4 Gospels. And I just want to, whether that's so or not, it's a way of sort of remembering some things. And here's what I'd like you to see. I've got in the middle of that page some things for you to know. I'd love to drag this out and let you watch it develop. I just don't have time to do that and do the other things I want to do tonight. The Gospels were not written for you in their immediate original writing. They were written for the people who were alive at the time the books were written. They have meaning for us as well, but they were written to specific groups, and they weren't written to the same groups. Matthew, we believe, was primarily written to Jewish people.
So there's lots of reference to the Old Testament in the book of Matthew. Why? Because the Jewish people would know about the Old Testament, and such references would be helpful. The book of Mark seems to have been written to the Romans. And when you think about the Romans, what you think is practical, common sense. If you're old enough to remember Dragnet, this is Jack Webb. Just a fact. And so in the book of Mark, my translation reads it like this. This happened, and at once this happened, and at once this happened. And all you have is just the succession of things that happened, just seemingly tumbling on top of one another. There's not a whole lot of commentary. There's not a whole lot of development of complicated ideas. It's just, you know, in Jesus' life, this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. Here's the things you need to know about Jesus. If you have somebody who needs to know about Jesus, and you want to have the simplest possible introduction, show them the book of Mark. Show them the book of Mark. But the book of Matthew, we think, was primarily written there. Now, when you take a look at these, Matthew, the symbol is lion, and if you listen to the titles that Jesus gets in the Old Testament and the New Testament, one of those titles is Lion of Judah. He came from the tribe of Judah. And they talk about Lion of Judah. So that particular symbol is there. The symbol for Mark, if you believe that symbolism, is the ox. It's like the Romans. Very powerful, but, you know, not a whole lot of smarts, not a whole lot of intellectual firepower. That was for the Greeks. Okay? Luke was written for the Greeks. Luke was written for people who wanted to know some of the details and some of the intentions of things. And you'll learn something about the book of Luke in a minute or two that I hope will stay with you that makes it even more interesting. The symbol for Luke might be man, because in this book, more of Jesus is presented that shows you his humanity. Jesus was human, just like we were. Jesus was also divine, and the book of John approaches that. You want a symbol for that? Use the symbol of the eagle. This is written for people who are on a spiritual quest, people who want to understand the spirituality of Jesus. Jesus' divinity was there. Yes, ma'am, Carol.
So, is it sometimes the symbol of the angel used for Luke?
Oh, I suppose there's a thousand symbols that could be used for any one of these. I'm simply saying those who look at that strange creature shown close to God's presence, and you see these four faces on it, if that is supposed to be somehow representative of the gospel and the power of the gospel, the good news of Jesus is carried in these books, then, you know, maybe you can make this association. Don't push that too far.
Okay.
Don't push that too far. Luke's full of stories. Mark's full of facts. Matthew is full of references. Cross-references to the Old Testament. And John is totally different. There's big arguments that you'll read if you read the commentators and you read the people who study this, the Bible, as literature. And they will tell you that they think there's a gospel that we don't have, that was the source of these others. Somebody wrote this gospel, we don't have it, but Mark and Matthew and Luke were all derived from it in some way or another, or were written in knowledge of it. And they will refer to that document as the source document for this, except they'll say it in German, where the word is Q-U-E-L-L-E, and they'll simply abbreviate it with Q. And if you ever see a commentary that says, well, in Q, there probably was this or so, that's what they're talking about. So far, okay? Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's so many parallel passages, it's not fun. And so some people refer to those three, not the four, those three, as synoptic gospels. Optic means what? Or seeing. Synoptic means with. And so what they're saying is with one eye. Synoptic, with one eye. If you ever get a parallel New Testament, I have one of those. I think I told you about having a translation that had four different translations on one page, right? Well, a parallel New Testament lays out, here's Mark, here's Matthew, here's Mark, here's Luke, here's John. And what you'll have is what Matthew says, here's the parallel in Mark, here's the parallel in Luke, here's the parallel in John. The parallel in John is mostly blank. But there's very often parallels with those three. So John is a very different rendering than the others. Okay? How you doing so far?
Just interesting.
Very interesting.
Did you already know this?
No.
So I'm not wasting your time.
I didn't know about the Q.
Okay. Well, they don't either.
Oh.
They just say, well, you know, there's so many passages in common, and we can't figure out that Matthew was first, and we can't figure out that Luke was first, so there must have been another one that was first, and we don't have it, and everybody else is coming from it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not giving them quite as much credit as they deserve, but that's still roughly what you can say. Now, if you take a look, point three on page one is what I just told you about with synoptic gospels. Point two tells you about Mark is probably the earliest, Luke is probably the latest. Point one tells you about Q and the source and all that. But wasn't it more fun to hear it the other way? Rather than just me reading you this?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, let me take you a couple of places. And I'm not necessarily going in order, but in the same kind of spirit, most of this is going to be in there somewhere. But just for fun, I want you to go to the first page of Acts and the first page of Luke. And I want the first page of Luke to be what you end up on. I want you to have a place, have your hand where you can go to Acts as soon as you need to. So find the first page of Acts, Acts 1-1. Don't read it. Just find it. And then go and find Luke 1-1. And as soon as you find it, do not read it. Just look up here. Tempting, isn't it? Hard to do, isn't it?
Yeah,
I know. Okay. Now, here's my question. Have you found Luke 1? Some of you are still looking. If you see somebody there, you start struggling to find it, help them a little bit, would you? I know I'm rushing you around from place to place. Okay. All right. How do you think the Gospel of Luke starts? Wouldn't you think it would start talking about Mary, maybe? Or talking about Joseph and Mary, or maybe talking about the Christmas story, something like that. Listen to how it starts. Seeing that many others have undertaken to draw up accounts of the events that have reached their fulfillment among us, what? And these were handed down to us by those who from the outset were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. This is one of the reasons folks think there might have been another document that Luke drew from. I, in my turn, after carefully going over the whole story from the beginning, have decided to write an ordered account for you, Theophilus, so that your excellency may learn how well founded is the teaching that you have received. Who in the world is Theophilus?
Some Greek.
Probably some Greek official who has come to faith. And Dr. Luke is trying to help him a little bit make deeper sense of that. Now, let me pause for a minute. Many of you are probably guests in our church. And welcome to you. I'm so glad you're here. But some of you are members of Bonaire. What do we do in Bonaire Baptist Church now if somebody comes forward and asks for membership? We ask something of them. What do we ask of them? Do you know? Have any of you joined recently?
You go through a lot.
Yes, but they ask you to do something. They ask you to attend a 4-week course on the joy of belonging. Why? So that we can tell you the joy that is yours by belonging to this church. We want to tell you what we stand for. We want to tell you what we're doing so that you can find your place in service. We want to make sure you understand some things, right? Well, we're not writing the book of Luke in the joy of belonging, but something like that appears to be what was going on. Somebody named Theophilus had become a Christian, right? So that you may learn, so your excellency may learn, this is verse 4, how well founded is the teaching that you have received. I want to make sure you know the full story of Jesus as much as I can tell you. So I've gone back into the records. Probably Luke did some eyewitness interviewing. I have a picture of him traveling throughout the Holy Land, traveling throughout Israel, and interviewing people, getting their stories, because Luke is the greatest storyteller in the New Testament, I think. Now, do you have Acts? In my earlier work, Theophilus, you see the first verse of Acts?
Wow.
Now, have you learned something? Yes. Acts is volume 2, and Luke is volume 1, and you ought to read them back to back because they make a complete story. Now, why don't we put them that way in the Bible? Because John was later, and because John is a gospel, we put John with the gospel, and then we put Acts over here. So I want you to know, the book of Luke is, I'm told, roughly one standard scroll in length. And the book of Acts is roughly one standard scrolling length. And so here's a two-volume set. Do you have books in your house? I hope so. You have books in your house that include a volume one and a volume two of something? That's what you got here. You don't have the clues. You don't, and this is true of much of the New Testament. There's a whole bunch of ones and twos in the New Testament, and you don't get the clues. Because the clues are 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. Those clues aren't here. So I just want you to know the book of Luke and the book of Acts, volume 1, volume 2. One tells the story of Jesus, and the other tells the story of the early church. They are not, here's the history book over here, and here's the Gospels over here. There's this beautiful connection between those two. Are you doing okay? All right. That's enough on that. Let's go to Matthew. Let's go to Matthew. I want to take you to some verses in Matthew. That's the first of the Gospels. And the verses in Matthew I'm going to take you to are not inspiring. These are not inspiring verses I'm taking you to. But I want to take you to those anyway. Ready? Acts, Matthew chapter 7, verse 28. And as soon as you have found it, as soon as you have found Matthew 7:28, don't bother to read it. I just want you to go to chapter 11, verse 1. And, you know, get a finger into that place as well. And then go over to chapter 13, verse 53. And that'll be enough. We'll have three things to look at. Let me say one more time. These are not inspiring verses. These verses are another point. Everybody ready? Matthew 7:28 was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew 7:28. Matthew 11:1 is the second one. And Matthew 13:53 is the third one. There is a fourth one. There is a fifth one. I'm not showing you those. You'll get the idea with these three. I'd like you to look at verse 28 in chapter 7 of Matthew and tell me what the first phrase is. Sort of read until it feels like your voice ought to stop and start up again. What's the first phrase?
So it was.
When Jesus had finished saying these things, I told you it wasn't very inspiring. Did you see that phrase? Does yours have a phrase like that? Okay, go to chapter 11, verse 1. After Jesus had finished instructing his disciples. Does that sound a lot like 7:28? Go to 13:53. When Jesus had finished these parables, etc., etc. Everybody okay? All right. I'm now ready to tell you how the book of Matthew is constructed. This is a literary construction that I'm giving. It has seven parts. It has a prologue. What's a prologue, those of you who have had English instruction? Those are some words that get you started, right? And it has an epilogue. What's that? That's one that finishes everything up. And in between the prologue and the epilogue, it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books or sections. Let's today call it sections. A lot of commentators call it books, and books within books doesn't help very much. So sections. Each of those sections has, first, a narrative section that's 2, 3, 4 chapters. Jesus went here and did this. He met this person. These things happened. This was said. And then everything sort of comes to a stop. And Jesus has a teaching section. He is teaching somebody or telling somebody something. Sometimes it's a group that's very large. Sometimes it's a group that's very small. And the verses I had you read are the verses that signal the end of a teaching section and therefore the start of the next narrative section. And there's 5 of those verses in the book of Matthew. The prologue is the Christmas story. The epilogue is certainly not an afterthought. The epilogue is the arrest, trial, crucifixion, and resurrection of our Lord. The 5 books or sections in between, narrative and a teaching section. Narrative and a teaching section. All of you, I think, will know the first of the teaching sections. The first section, the teaching part, is the Sermon on the Mount. It runs Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And at the end of Matthew 7 is this verse that I took you to, when Jesus had finished all he wanted to say, then it started up again. The literary structure of the book is prologue, the Christmas story, and then the first section, a narrative and a teaching section, that's the Sermon on the Mount. Then another narrative and a teaching section, another, until you got five of those narratives followed by teaching sections. And then the ending of the book, the prologue, if you will, is Jesus' arrest, trial, crucifixion, resurrection. How are you doing so far? That means if the Sermon on the Mount is important to you, and it should be, there's four more of those in that book to go look for. There's a teaching on missionary work. There's a teaching on parallel, on parables. There's a teaching on last things. What's going to be like at the end of the world? He's got a teaching on that. There's four more of those besides the Sermon on the Mount. And I invite you to go find those. All right? Now, that's the literary structure of the book. Let me now tell you the theological or spiritual construction of the book. The spiritual construction of the book hinges in the middle of Matthew. And it hinges on a moment when he quits doing one thing and starts to do something else. Let me help you with that. For the first half of the book of Matthew, what Jesus is trying to do is by his actions and by his words lead people to begin to realize who he is. Who is he? Who is he? Your turn. Who is he? Who is Jesus? He is God's Messiah. He is God's Son. He is human and divine. And he was sent to be our Savior and the Savior of the whole world. That's who he is. But here's the deal. He's not going to walk up and say, I'm the Savior of the world. He's just going to do and say the things that need to be done and said in the normal course of things. And eventually, somebody is going to figure out who he is. And once that happens, that person, it turns out not to be a person, it turns out to be a small group, but there is a person within that group who expresses it first. Once that happens, then that part is over, and he's ready to begin the second half, which is to try to help people understand what he came here to do. What did he come here to do? What did Jesus come here to do? How is he going to save us? How is he going to forgive our sins? He is going to die on the cross, and in his death, he takes the death that should belong to us and sets us free. He is going to die for us on a Roman cross. That's what he came to do. Now, I want to take you to that point, and I want you to see the hinge that this happens. It is in Matthew chapter 16. And I think I want, in order to help you see what I'm talking about, I want you to look, first of all, at verse 21. This again, I'm looking at words that are not in and of themselves inspirational. But I want you to see that. What are the first three or four words of chapter 16, verse 21? What are the first two or three words you see? From that time onwards. That's your clue. Up to this point, what has Jesus been doing? By his actions, by his words. What's he been doing? Trying to help people understand and come to realize who he is by an act of faith and belief. Not by being told, but by seeing the evidence and reaching the conclusion through faith's eyes. From that point on, what's he doing? He's beginning to help them understand what he came to do and how it's going to happen. Now, I want you to see this whole hinge. So back up to verse 13. Chapter 16, Matthew, verse 13. You ready? Yes? No? You ready? Everybody ready? When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, if you say it like you know what you're doing, people believe you do. He put this question to his disciples. Who do people say the Son of Man is? He had a way of talking about himself in the third person. That's an echo of Daniel. That's an echo of Ezekiel. And they said, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, some Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But you, he said, who do you say I am? And Simon Peter spoke up, and he said, you're the Christ. That's the Greek word for Messiah. You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, Simon, son of Jonah, you are a blessed man, because it was no human agency that revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. Now look at the next words and think about our Catholic friends and what they do with this verse. So I now say to you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my community. The gates of the underworld can never overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. And he gave the disciples strict orders not to say to anyone that he was the Messiah. Why? Because everybody has to come in faith. Not because of what you told me, but because of what I see in Jesus and the evidence of my life.
Okay?
Our Catholic friends say this is the moment that Jesus put Peter in charge of the church. And if he's in charge of the church, then he's infallible, right? Verse 21. From then onwards, my chapter says, Jesus began to make it clear to his disciples that he was destined to go to Jerusalem, suffer grievously at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes, be put to death, and to be raised up on the third day. What's Peter's first action after what Jesus said to him in the previous thing? Taking him aside, Peter started to rebuke him. Heaven preserve you, Lord, he said. This must not happen to you. But Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're an obstacle in my path because you're not thinking as God thinks. You're thinking as human beings do. Evangelical Christians don't believe Peter was made the first pope by that action, and one of the pieces of evidence is the very first thing he did was anything but infallible. In fact, it was demonic, Jesus. Peter's just one of us. Right? Peter says, Lord, this must not happen to you. Why? Because Peter couldn't see any way that anything good could come out of Jesus' dying. I don't think Satan saw it either. I think Satan thought, if I just get the people to kill him, that'll be the end of it. I don't think Satan was allowed to see the resurrection before it happened. I think Satan was shocked on Easter Sunday morning at a level that is incomprehensible to us. Because I think he thought, if I can just get them to kill him, it'll all be over. And Peter's thinking that way too. You with me? Book of Matthew, how's it constructed? 7 parts. A prologue, which is? The Christmas story. 5 sections, which each have a narrative at the front and a teaching at the back. And one of those, the first, is the Sermon on the Mount. There's others on missionary work. There's others on parables. There's others on last things. There's one I don't remember. And then there's an epilogue, which is? The arrest, the trial, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. Thank God, and the resurrection. But theologically, the book of Matthew is constructed by the first half dealing with who he is by his words and by his actions, offering to people the chance to see him as he is. And finally, a small group does that we identify as his disciples with Peter as their spokesman. And immediately, from that point on, the rest of the book is dealing with what? Trying to help people understand. And even at the end, as the resurrection came, he had still not been successful in getting his disciples to see that, because they still thought it was awful. They still thought it was awful. And Easter Sunday came. If you can ever see Easter through that lens, you'll never see it the same way again. That's the book of Matthew. How you doing?
I don't have time to do the book of Mark. I just don't. I'm sorry. I don't. Jack Webb, just the facts, ma'am, at once. That's all you get. Okay? Let's go to the book of John. Yes, sir.
Of the 4 Gospels and the writers, which ones actually knew Jesus personally?
I'm sorry, I should have said that. Let me try to help you with that for just a moment. Who was Matthew? Do you know?
Matthew was one of the disciples. What was his occupation before he became a disciple? He was a tax collector. I invite you to read the book of Matthew and watch what Matthew, the tax collector, has to say about tax collectors. If it does not move you to tears at two spots, I'll be shocked. Because he is saying something that's so condemning of tax collectors. But he's saying it as a tax collector who was saved from that. And the poignancy that's in that, I cannot overestimate. Who was John? Another one of the disciples, probably the youngest one, probably the kid who was there. He seems to be able to go places and do things that the others couldn't. And one way of explaining that was he was close enough to being a child that he wasn't a threat. He was a young man, but not old enough to really be a threat like the big burly fisherman would have been. Okay? And he lived the longest. And his gospel is written probably out of the reflection of all that time. Most Bible commentators believe, I think they're probably right, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and maybe another copy or two like Q were in circulation. And John looks and says, okay, what is it they aren't saying that needs to be said about Jesus? They're not talking about Jesus as God. They're not talking about Jesus. That's what I need to write about. Okay? So that leaves us with Mark and Luke, right? Who was Mark? The best answer I can give you is he was Peter's cousin. And most people think Mark's gospel is affected by Peter. So if you want to know what Mark is writing, Mark is probably writing things he's heard from Peter or has recorded for Peter or something. Mark is the writer, but probably it's reflecting Peter's insight. And Peter was an uneducated fisherman. So it kind of fits. So how about Luke? Whose gospel is that? Well, if you go to the book of Acts, what you find is Luke was a traveling companion of Paul's. The first time you see Luke, he was a traveling companion of Paul's. And a lot of people, and I'm one of them, thinks this is the gospel that comes out of Paul's insights. One of the people trying to stamp out Christianity by killing all the Christians, throwing them into jail. And he has this dramatic conversion experience, goes into the desert for 3 years to try to figure out how could I have missed it so far, and then comes out as a powerful champion of Christianity, not even trusted by some of the Christians that he had tried to persecute until much time goes by. And Luke spent all this time with him, and a lot of people think what Luke has talked about comes out of that. Plus, I would add, I think Luke was a historian as well as a doctor. I think he was going back in and interviewing people, because some of the stories he tells has the sense of sort of almost a you were there account of some of his details are brought out that are just wonderful. So I think probably Matthew and John were disciples, Mark coming from the disciple Peter. And then Luke coming from eyewitness interviews with disciples and with people who had interacted with Jesus and some of the insights of Paul. Does that help you, sir? Does that help you?
Are you saying Mark never knew Jesus personally?
Oh, I'm sure he knew Jesus personally. But I'm saying, I don't think so. I think Luke's is more of a historical record, and therefore what comes through as first person, I think it's coming from some kind of interaction with the people who knew him. I think Luke is much more the historian's touch of this, and what you're hearing are the stories that the people told, and Luke is weaving those together so that you can see a picture of Jesus through the stories. Luke has the great story. Okay? Let's go to the book of John. I want you to go first to the end of the book of John. And I want you to find John chapter 20, and I want you to look for verse 30. John chapter 20, verse 30. Have you found it? Everybody ready? John chapter 20, verse 30. There were many other signs. Some translations say miracles. Some one or two translations say mighty acts, but I think miracles is probably the best word. Signs is probably the second best word. There were many other signs or miracles that Jesus worked in the sight of the disciples, but they are not recorded in this book. Yes, that's what it says, or no, that's not. Did that capture it?
Yes.
Verse 31. These are recorded. Which ones? The ones I recorded are recorded for a purpose. What's the purpose? One, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life. The book of John was written to bring you, the reader, into the kingdom. And he says this, I have put miracle stories in here, and I have not begun to put them all. I've just put a few. And everyone that I've put in tells you an inescapable, important piece of who Jesus is. And if you take what those miracles or signs tell you, you have a complete picture of Jesus. Now, how many signs does he record? Seven. He records seven. Let me show you the first one. Let me show you the first one. Still in the book of John? Go to chapter 2. And, cutting to the chase, I want you to read the first few words of verse 11. Chapter 2, first few words of verse 11. What does it say? This is the first of Jesus' signs or miracles. Do you see it? Yes? Now, please listen. Was this the first miracle he did?
I think it was.
The proper answer is, I don't know. But it's the first one John is recording. John says at the end of the book, I haven't recorded all the ones that Jesus did. But the ones I have recorded are recorded for a purpose. The purpose is, one, no, the purpose of recording. I'm reviewing. I'm trying to get this locked in your brain. So that you will believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life through His name. Now, I'm with you. I think this probably is the first one he did. But I'm not gonna anchor myself there because John doesn't anchor himself there. I'm simply going to say, this is the first one John thinks. If you want to know the important things about Jesus as revealed through the miracles he did, here's the first one you need to know about. Got it? Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't looked at the miracle, right? We're going to do that in a minute. But I want to go just a little bit further. I want you to go to chapter 4, verse 54. Chapter 4, verse 54. Once again, I'm taking you places tonight that aren't particularly inspirational. In between, there's lots of good stuff. What does this say? This miracle, this new sign, the second. And then it goes on and talks about that, right? So here's what I'm telling you. The book of John tells you the first one. Hey, here's the first one. It comes to the second. Hey, here's the second, and then it quits. It figures from that point on, you can count. And then at the end of the book, it says, now did you notice I've been showing you miracles? And I've shown you seven. And if you got those seven miracles in place and you understand what they tell you about Jesus, then you understand what you need to know about Jesus. You've got the essence of what you need to know. In order that you may believe that He's the Messiah, the Son of God, God's servant, sent into the world to save the world. And that as a result of believing, you may have life. The book of 1 John, which is also written by this same person, says, if you have the Son, you have life. If you do not have the Son, you do not have life. I've written this book so that you can have life. Same message. Very similar message between these two books. You doing okay? All right, now very quickly, if you'll turn to the top of page 4, I want to take this so slowly. Oh, I want to take this so slowly. I can't do it. I can't do it, but if you'll take a look at the top of page 4. Now, in your translation, Does it say on 1B, 4, colon, 46-50, C verse 50? Scratch out C verse 50. Scratch out the 0 and put a 4 because it's verse 54. I want you to see that's what we just did. It's verse 54. It's not verse 50 that shows you, hey, this is the second sign. Okay, what was the first? What was the first miracle? Water into wine. What was the second one? The cure of the son of a nobleman. And there's the third one and the fourth one and the fifth one and the sixth one and the seventh one. Okay? Look over in the right-hand column. I've put down here messianic titles that are associated with each of these signs. Jesus says, he stands up in the marketplace in Jerusalem and he shouts to the crowd, hey, if you're thirsty, come to me. I'm living water. Because there's another way to look at the book of John. Look at part 2. Do you remember way back in Genesis when Moses was being called and God said to him, when Moses said, I don't even know your name, God said, here's my name. What was God's name? What did he say? I am. Through the book of John, almost a dozen times, I think, you see John recording Jesus' words. I am living water. I am bread of life. And that is not an accident, folks. That is not an accident. And I've got a list of places where you'll find things like that. Okay? And just for fun, let me go back to the miracles for a second. The first miracle, turning water into wine. In every sign, something happens that if it's going to be solved or if the need is going to be met, it's not going to be met by human agency. The only way to meet it is with a miracle. Secondly, in almost every case, I think in every case, some time goes by to where the situation gets desperate. And then Jesus acts, and in that action, the only explanation for it is the divine power was at work. What happened when the water was turned into wine? What was the situation? There was a wedding going on, and what had happened? They were in the process. They were just about to run out of wine. Here's a big party going on, and the host is going to run out of refreshments. How horrible. And Jesus' mother comes to Jesus and says, they've run out of wine. And Jesus says the strangest thing. What does that have to do with me, woman? Or works to that effect. Do you know what his mother says? She says nothing to him. She turns to some servants and she says, whatever he says to do, you do it. And I have a picture of her leaving the room. And Jesus says to the servants, you see those big jars over there? There's these huge jars that contain water that you're supposed to use to wash when you come in because that makes you ritually clean to enter someone's house. And he says, go fill them with fresh water. And they do that. And he says, okay, now take a ladle full to the master of the ceremonies. And he takes a taste and he says, ooh, nobody ever throws parties like this. They bring out the bad stuff when everybody is, one translation says, well-wined. Good line, don't you think? You get them liquored up, their taste is gone. Then you bring out the inferior stuff. He said, you've saved the best to last. You saved the best to last. And the only people who knew were who? The servants. Until they started to cut. Nobody else knew. The second miracle is even more interesting. Yeah.
Well, you need to believe her saying that she realized that it was God at his time, on God's time, he would have given us.
I don't know. I think it could be. I have a picture of a very intimate relationship between Jesus and his mother. I have pictures of him talking about things that he's beginning to understand who he is. And my sense is he did not immediately know who he was when he was born as Messiah. I think he grew into that as a human being and began to realize it. there are fanciful books that survive from that age that are not included in the Bible that have Jesus doing all kinds of, I don't think any of that's true. But I think he began to realize something special was happening in his life. And I think he talked to his mother about it. And I suspect they had been talking, you know, it's about to start. It's about to start. And yeah, I think possibly it was, I don't think it was the beginning of a conversation, but I think it may have been the end of one. But we don't know. So the first answer is I don't know, but probably. But she was saying, you know, you've got to start somewhere. This is a place where you can do some good. And I don't know that she knew what he was going to do. I don't think she would have assumed that. But she had a role of some kind to play, yes.
Most of the miracles of healing someone or something to almost... I mean, running out of wine didn't seem very bad to me.
Didn't, did it?
No. So...
Didn't, did it?
Right. How did that help? I mean, I don't understand the purpose. It really wasn't...
What's the highest joy you have ever had in your life? Boy, I hope you
get it right.
That's right.
I guess marriage and a child.
Yeah. And what's Jesus saying? Everybody who comments on this from a pulpit usually gets this right. Jesus is holding up marriage and saying, I want marriage to be even happier than it's possible for it to be. Now, stop and look what Jesus himself says about marriage as you move on through the New Testament. The relationship of Jesus to his church is the relationship of marriage. And I think if you have just that much, you can start to understand why it started there.
Okay.
I think if you just have that much, you can have a sense of why it might have started there. Otherwise, it does look pretty simple. But when you put that to it, I don't think it's so simple anymore. And I've thought through that, and that's the conclusion I've reached.
Okay.
I want you to look at the second one, though. This, I think, is chapter 4. Is that right? I'm still in Luke. No wonder I'm not finding it. Come on. Chapter 4, verse 46. Okay? He went again to Cana in Galilee, where he had changed the water into wine. First two miracles were in the same place. And there was a court official whose son was ill at Capernaum. Where's Capernaum? Capernaum is about a half a day's journey. 4 or 5 hours away. If you run, maybe it was 3 hours away. Hearing that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, pause for a minute. Go to the last page of this lesson. Hold your place in the lesson. Just go to the last page of it. Keep going. It's the last page. It's the last page before the first page of the next lesson. There's a map. See that map? Do you see the Dead Sea at the bottom?
Yes.
You see the Sea of Galilee at the top? You see the Jordan River in between?
Yes.
Jordan River. Chilean. Okay. Do you see where it says Judea down at the bottom? That's what's left of the southern kingdom. Do you see Samaria to the north?
Yeah.
Do you see Galilee even north of that? Okay. Samaria is what's left of that group, the northern kingdom, that was taken off into exile and intermarried, and so what's there, the Jews thought were half-breeds. Jesus lived in Galilee. Jerusalem was down in Judea. So when he says he just had arrived from Galilee to Judea, that means he's made that trip. Okay? That's, I just want you to see that picture as we go along. I'm back in John chapter 4. Are you back in John chapter 4? Court official was ill at Capernaum. If you go to that map, you might be able to see Capernaum. If you've got maps in your Bible, you can maybe see that as well. Hearing that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went and asked him to come and cure his son, as his son was at the point of death. Jesus answered him, "Unless you see signs of importance, you will not believe." "Sir," answered the official, "come down before my child dies." Jesus is saying, "You're just looking for signs." And the man says, "No, I'm looking for a child to stay alive." "Go home," said Jesus. "Your son will live." Now, I want you to hear this carefully. The focus of this story is not the live son. The man believed what Jesus had said. That's verse 50. Did you say that? I've got that underlined. The man believed what Jesus said and went on his way home. And while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was alive. He asked them when the boy had begun to recover, and they replied, "The fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour." And the father realized this was exactly the time when Jesus had said, "Your son will live," and he and all his household believed.
Don't miss it. How far was it from where he was to where his boy was? 3 or 4 hours?
Probably more.
3 or 4 hours. That's it. 3 or 4 hours. When did his son get better? Yesterday at the seventh hour. Where's the man? He ain't home yet. His servants met him on the way. Do you see it yet? He believed what Jesus said. My son is well. I don't need to go look and make sure. So he finishes the business that had brought him to this place. And now he's on his way home. And his servants meet him. Your son is alive. Do you hear the faith of this man? It's hiding in the words. Do you hear it? And when the father told the household, the whole of the household believed. That's a good one. That's a good one. What was the third one? Cure of a man paralyzed for 38 years. I want you to take a look at the question. The question is in the tail end of verse 6. Verse 5, one man was there who had an illness which had lasted 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had been in that condition for a long time, he said what? You want to get well? What does the man say? What in the world does that mean? Well, you have to go to Luke. Because this is one of the places where there is a little bit of a parallel. Maybe it's Matthew. But there's a little bit of a parallel. Because what they said was, they had a belief that every once in a while an angel would come down and trouble the water. The water would just begin to move for no reason. Maybe they were on an earthquake fault and something like that was happening. Or maybe there was an angel doing that. I don't know. But the people believe the first one in the pool gets healed and nobody else does. And the man is basically saying, I've got nobody to help me into the pool. Do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? Sir, replied the sick man, I have no one to put me in the pool. While I'm still on the way, somebody else gets there before me. Jesus says, get up, pick up your sleeping mat, and walk around. If you've been lying there paralyzed for 38 years, and somebody comes along and says, you want to be well? What's your reply? What do you think? Oh, Jesus got a little bit more polite answer than that. A little bit more polite answer than that. And then the person says, get up. What do you say? You kidding me? I've been here 38 years. You think I can get up? What does the man say to that? He says nothing. He gets up. And in the act of trying to get up, he can get up. Mm-hmm. It takes faith to try something for the 1,000th, or 10,000th, or 100,000th time.
This one really gets to me.
Oh, they all get to me after a while, but yeah. There's no more argument from the man. You can almost hear the belief. If you're telling me to try to get up and walk around, then I can do it.
Immediately.
I believe it was as he was getting up. There's a parallel in the Old Testament. There's a military commander who has taken over the area where Israel is. It's back in the Judges, I think. And the military commander has leprosy. And he comes to the nation. And he says to the king, I hear you have prophets here. I want them to cure me of my leprosy. Nobody's cured of leprosy. That doesn't happen. That's a dead end. Although Leviticus does say what to do if you are cured from leprosy, it still can't be cured. Interesting disease. Keep your eye on that disease. There's more to that disease than meets the eye. So he gets to the prophet, and the king is beside himself. This guy's going to get so mad he's going to kill us all before he dies of leprosy. And the prophet, I forget who it was, I think it was Elijah or Elisha, says, don't worry about that, I'll talk to him. And he says to go dip yourself 7 times in the Jordan River. And the guy goes off in a huff. How dare he? That dirty river. I have beautiful rivers at home. Dip myself in that river? I should say not. Except he had a little Israelite servant girl. And the little servant girl says, "My Lord, if he had asked you to do something great, wouldn't you have done it? So why don't you do the little thing he asked you to do?" And he dips himself 7 times in the Jordan River. And he's healed. Very few people in the whole of the Bible are ever reported having a cure for leprosy. This is one of them. I see a parallel. The man paralyzed for 38 years. Jesus says to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, walk around." And he tries. And in the trial, he's healed. I don't think he was healed until he tried. If the Lord asked of you some great thing, wouldn't you do it? So why don't you do the little thing? Man, what a question. It's a good one, isn't it? That's 3. We can run out of time right here if we're not careful. Feeding of 5,000. Whose faith
is on display here?
It's not the disciples. Jesus said, "We got 5,000 men here, not counting the women and children. We got 5,000 men here. How are we going to feed them all?" And the disciples say, "Lord, if we had a year's wages from 100 people, there wouldn't be enough money to buy food enough to feed all these folks." Well, what do we have? And one disciple, it's the beautiful disciple, it's Andrew, I think, steps out of the group and says, "Well, there is this one kid here, and he's got 5 little loaves of bread and 2 fish. And Jesus says, "Give them to him." And at the end of the feeding of 5,000 men and who knows how many women and children, they collected 12 baskets full of food from what was left over. How many disciples were there? How many baskets were there? Don't miss that one. Let me tell you something about that. How is it that you and I eat our food? I'm a chemist. I study this a little bit. There's carbon dioxide and water in the air. And it's pulled out of the air into the plants. And the plants grow. God gives the increase, is the way Paul puts it. And when the plants grow, they have fruit, or they have grain, or they have other things that we can eat. And all Jesus did was do it quicker. It's still a miracle that we can eat. He just did it in a moment or two, as opposed to doing it over a little bit longer time. It's still a miracle that food comes the way it does. When perceptive people see something to be grateful for in any meal. Walking on water. I like Luke's version of this better than I like John's version of this. But the story goes something like this. They're out of the boat. They're trying to cross the Sea of Galilee. A storm comes up. The boat is being tossed and pitched by a horrible windstorm. Lightning is crashing. Everything's happening. And Jesus is asleep in the bottom of the boat. Jesus is asleep in the bottom of the boat. I had flu last week. On Monday and Tuesday, I was sick as a dog. I came in here and tried to hide that fact from you on Wednesday that I wasn't feeling very good. I hope I was successful. But I tell you, I sit down at night, I'm still tired, and I'll fall dead asleep like I usually don't. It's just this last few days. I think Jesus was just physically tired, and he'd fallen asleep. And I think it's in Luke's story. The disciples go to wake him up, and here's their words: "Lord, don't you care that we're about to die?" And Jesus stands up, and I'm going to give you the picture I have. I don't know if I'm right. I don't know if I'm right, but I think this is what happened. Jesus stands up, turns around, and shouts to the wind and waves, "Would you just shut up a minute? I can't hear what they're saying." They quit, and he says, "What?" I think that's what happened in that story. "Don't you care that we're about to die?" And he says, "Shut up a minute, I can't hear them. What'd you say?" Mm-hmm.
Mexico?
What do you say? Who is this man
whose voice the wind and the waves obey?
I think Jesus at that moment, this is just me, I think at that moment some of his humanity came through along with his divinity. And I think he used power in a way that normally he wouldn't have. And I really do believe something like that is what happened.
Would you just shut up a minute? I can't hear you.
Now what? If it wasn't like that, I think it was close to that.
Nature is under Jesus' control. I'm leaving out. You know, I can't tell you how much I'm leaving out. Cure the Man Born Blind, chapter 9, is so good. It's so good. I'm going to trust you to get everything you can out of this stuff with the list and all that, but I got to take some time for this one. John, chapter 9. As he went along, he, that is Jesus, saw a man who had been blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should have been born blind?
One of the things I try to teach my students is you always got to listen to your questions to hear the assumptions that are hiding in them. I teach chemistry, but you still have to do this. What are the assumptions hiding in the disciples' question? Somebody sinned. Somebody's being punished.
Here's Jesus' answer. Neither. Not him and not his parents. Neither sinned. He was born blind so that the works of God might be revealed in him. I could spend, I think, a half an hour on that sentence. I'll try not to do that. But look, this is one of those places where Jesus' statement of himself comes right here with it. Look at what he says. As long as the day lasts, we must carry out the work of the one who sent me. The night will soon be here when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. That's the messianic title that goes with this sign, this miracle, and it's also one of the great I am statements. Having said this, he spat on the ground, made a paste with the spittle, put it over the eyes of the blind man, and said to him, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. The word Siloam means one who has been sent. And so the man went off and washed and came back able to see. So far, okay? Has this guy ever seen Jesus?
Not yet.
You with me? Okay. His neighbors and the people who used to see him before, for he had been a beggar, said, isn't this the man who used to sit and beg? Yes, some said. It is the same one. Others said, no, it's just somebody who looks exactly like him. Are you reading along with me? Is that what it says? The man himself said, oh yes, I'm the one. And they said to him, but you can see. How is it your eyes were opened? And he said, the man named Jesus made a paste, daubed my eyes with it, and said to me, go and wash off at Siloam. I went, and when I washed, I gained my sight. And they asked him, where is he? And he said, I don't know. I don't even know what he looks like, he could have said. Yeah, he doesn't. He knows there was a paste, but he doesn't know how the paste was made. Did you notice that?
At that point, it didn't matter to him.
Yeah. However, the Jews would not believe that the man had been blind without first sending for the parents of the man who had gained his sight and asking them, is this man really the son of yours who you say was born blind? You catch the little piece in there? I hope that when we've ended this 8 weeks, you can start to read the Bible and start to see little pieces like that. I hope you can start to do that. Because everything starts to come alive when you can hear irony, when you can hear insight offered but overlooked. Is this man really the son of yours who you say was born blind? If so, how is it that he is now able to see? His parents said, we know he's our son, and we know he was born blind, but how he can see, we don't know. nor who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's old enough. Let him speak for himself. Why are they talking this way? Because they're afraid of the Jewish authorities who are clamping down on anybody who's expressing belief in Jesus. They know what's coming. His parents spoke like this out of fear of the Jews, just in case you think I was making that up. Read the next couple of verses. They had already agreed to ban from the synagogue anyone who should acknowledge Jesus as Christ. That's why the parents said, he's old enough, ask him. So the Jews sent for the man again, these are the Jewish leaders, and said to him, give glory to God. We are satisfied that this man is a sinner. Jesus they're talking about. The man answered, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. All I know is I was blind and now I can see. Folks, that's pretty hard evidence. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He replied, I told you once and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it all again? Ooh. Do you want to become his disciples yourself? Mine simply says, at this point, they hurled abuse at him. It is you who are his disciples. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. The man replied, that's just what's so amazing. You don't know where he comes from, and he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but God does listen to men who are devout and do his will. Ever since the world began, it's unheard of for anyone to open the eyes of a man who were born blind. If this man were not from God, he wouldn't have been able to do anything. They retorted, are you trying to teach us? And you a sinner through and through ever since you were born? And they kicked him out. Well, they ejected him, mine says, but that's kicked him out. Threw him out yourself. Jesus heard that he had been thrown out of the synagogue. And when he found him, he said to him, do you believe in the Son of Man? Sir, the man replied, tell me who he is so that I may believe in him. This man still doesn't know what Jesus looks like. Jesus said, you've seen him. He's speaking to you. And the man said, Lord, I believe. And worshiped him. There are none so blind as those who will not see. Chapter 11 is the big one. He raises Lazarus from the dead. He hears that Lazarus is sick and he refuses to go. His disciples say, we better get up and go or we're going to get there too late. Lazarus is going to be dead. And Jesus wouldn't go. And when he gets there, Lazarus is dead in the grave 3 days. And he cries with the people who are crying. And he goes to the grave, and he says, roll the stone away. And then he shouts out, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus steps out. And Jesus says, loose him, for they've bound him with grave clothes. I heard somebody say one time, why did Jesus say what he said? Why didn't he just say, come out? Why did he say, Lazarus, come out? You got an answer for that one? Because if he had just said, come out, they might have all come out. Don't laugh too hard. Don't laugh too hard. This was the tripping point. If you read what the Jewish leaders said, they said, that's it. We got to get rid of this guy. And the march to the cross began. Now, I've got one more little thing to show you. And it's all I have time for. There's so much more, and I hope that you'll read it. I've got a whole section on Acts. I hope you'll read that. It's at the tail end of this thing. I've got a little bit on Acts. We'll try to sneak a little bit of it in the next time. Oh, man. Okay. A long time ago, I showed you with Samuel and Saul. When the people said to Samuel, give us a king so we can be just like everybody else. Remember that day? I think it was the day we talked about history. Remember that? Okay. And I told you there was a parallel in the New Testament. I want to show you that. John chapter 19, verse 12. Some things that happened. And it says, chapter 19, verse 12, from that moment, Pilate was anxious to set him free. But the Jews shouted, if you set him free, you're no friend to Caesar's. Anyone who makes himself king is defying Caesar. Hearing those words, Pilate had Jesus brought out and seated him where? On the chair of judgment. Who did the crowd think was on trial? Jesus. Who was sitting in the seat of judgment? Jesus. Who was on trial? The crowd. This is the place the judge sits. And here's the crowd. It was the day of preparation, about the sixth hour. Here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews. Verse 15, but they shouted, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said, shall I crucify your king? The chief priest answered.
What did they say? We have no king but Caesar.
Pilate handed them over to him to be crucified. I got one last thing to show you. Simon Peter has denied Jesus three times. He's denied he even knows him. And he's gone off in grief and agony. And Jesus has been crucified. But now he's been resurrected. He's back. And Peter goes fishing. Chapter 21 of John. Chapter 21. Verse 1, later on, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples. It was by the Sea of Tiberias. And it happened like this. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two more of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter says, I'm going fishing. And off they went. When it was already light, verse 4, there stood Jesus on the shore, though the disciples did not realize it was Jesus. And Jesus called out, have you caught anything, friends? And they shouted back, no. And he said, throw the net out to starboard and you'll find something. And they threw the net out and could not haul it in because of the quantity of fish. The disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John's way of speaking of himself, said to Peter, it's the Lord. And at those words, Simon Peter tied his outer garment around him, for he had nothing on. Does yours say that? They fished naked in those days. Jumped into the water. The other disciples came on in the boat, towing the net with the fish. They were only about 100 yards from land. As soon as they came ashore, they saw there was some bread there and a charcoal fire with fish cooking on it. And they have meal. They have food. 153 fish they caught, it says. Verse 15, when they had eaten, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these others do? Yes, Lord, he said, you know I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my lambs. Second time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he replied, Lord, you know I love you. And Jesus said, look after my sheep. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt that he asked him a third time. And he said, Lord, you know everything. You know I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Most commentators think this was the moment where Peter was resurrected himself, returned to active service, and he became a fearless leader for the rest of his life. Most of the disciples were crucified or otherwise martyred. But let me tell you a little bit about this story. Jesus' question has to be understood in the Greek language because he says, do you love me? He says, agape, which is God's kind of love. And Peter answers, Lord, you know I filio you, brotherly love. Jesus said, Peter, do you agape me? Lord, you know I filio you. And the third time Jesus says, Peter, do you filio me? And it nearly breaks Peter's heart. Listen to the anguish. Lord, you know everything about me. As imperfect as I am, you know I love you the best I can. Feed my lambs. As far as we know, Peter never went fishing again after that moment. He was off doing other things. That's the best I can do at getting the Gospels to come alive for you. I hope it's helped. Good night.